This is a special episode of the Immunology Podcast, Immunology 2024, Day 3. Hey everyone, this is Dr. Jason Goldsmith and Dr. Brenda Rowd. Welcome back to the Immunology Podcast, where we have conversations with immunologists. We're back with our third episode covering highlights from Immunology 2024 taking place in Chicago. Brenda and I are having so much fun attending and getting to meet you all, but it's not over yet. If you're looking out to find out about what we're up to at the meeting, follow us on X at @ImmunoPodcast. You'll also find episodes covering the two previous days of the meeting at www.immunologypodcast.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Today, we'll be discussing our favorite sessions through day three of the meeting. So if you were in another session or weren't able to attend the meeting, we've got you covered. We're also going to be kicking off things in just a minute, but before we get to that,
are you working with blood-derived human cell types? Visit Stem Cell at booth 603 and request your free copy of a human cell wall chart for a quick reference on frequencies and percentages of more than 35 cell types to support your research from Stem Cell Technologies. You can also explore a range of immunology wall charts and order your copy for free at stemcell.com/immunologywallchart.
All right. Halfway through.
Oh, yeah. What a day. Fun. We had some nice conversations with participants this morning, didn't we?
Yes, that'll be coming out in a bit. Mm-hmm. Is our usual on the ground episode. So
indeed.
We started those today. And we got I got a good mix of things in. Not as much intestine this time either for me.
Oh, you're evolving. Okay. So show me what horizons have you broadened?
Let's see here. Well, I went to microbial and parasitic infections.
Infections, I guess that's
broader.
All right.
You don't just get infections in your gut, Brenda.
I'll bite.
All right, so this was cellular responses to microbial and parasitic infections. The first talk I saw was from E. Yvonne Jean at UPenn, my old stomping ground. It was IL-33 controls gamma delta T cell mediated resistance to skin penetrating helminths. So, you know, these little worms that come in through your skin and your feet and then infect you. Yeah, you got the shivers, exactly. So, IL-33 is known to be important for preventing helminth infection. They're trying to find out how its loss was preventing resistance. So you have IL-33, they did a knockout, and they did an ST2, which is the receptor knockout. And showed in both cases, these mice lost resistance to a mouse helminth. And they're trying to figure out what's caused it. And they were noticing it through some cellular approaches and they didn't do tissue specific knockout, but they did some cell mapping and showing where signaling was perturbed, that the gamma delta T cells were important. And again, this is preliminary work, grad student type of thing. But they were able to show that it was upregulating a catenin gene, CTNNA2, which is important in barrier integrity. And so they're finding that actually basal gamma delta IL-33 activity strengthens the barrier between your tight junctions on your skin to prevent the worms from coming in.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that was neat. The next talk was super interesting, but also the story was hard to follow and get into, but the top line I at least want to talk about for a second. And I'm going to try on this name, but I am not going to succeed. It is Papanathan Kumarasan from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Institute. It's a novel lentiviral vector-based approach to generate CAR T cells targeting Aspergillus fumigatus. So fungal infections are bad. We often can't kill them when they go on. So one of the main protections against fungal infections is actually our body temperature. And over the last few decades, our body temperature has been dropping. It's no longer 37°C is not the average body temperature anymore. Partially it's because we're all less inflamed from being sick from parasites as often and other things. But as a result of that, plus the ambient temperature of the earth rising means that fungi who like to be in that 30°C zone, you know, the environment is more hospitable and the human host is more hospitable. And we don't have as good antifungals as we do antibacterials because fungal cells are much closer to human cells. And so having the ability to kill a fungus without a human cell is much harder. So putting all that together, there's a lot of work looking now at like these deadly fungal infections that pop up in hospitals and they have to like rip the drywall out and then they can come back years later anyway. And it's nasty. So I don't have a bunch here I can talk about, but he made a Dectin-1 CAR T cell. Dectin-1 is on the fungi, and it was shown to inhibit in vitro growth and then target Aspergillus in lung tissue in a mouse model, and it suppresses the growth there. So that's all I got, but it's really cool from it. But it's for top line is you can do CAR T cells for fungi that are fungi specific. Yeah, I like that. Last up is a guy named Alex Hopke at the Eastern Tennessee State University, characterization of the molecular mediators of neutrophil swarming against Candida albicans. Again, Candida, another fungi, bad. Neutrophil swarming is this phenomenon where one neutrophil pulls more neutrophils, which pull more neutrophils, pull more to pile on into dealing with infection. It's hard to study in vitro, this author mentions, and in zebrafish and mouse models have some known differences from human behavior. So he created a new assay, and it was hard to get all of what they were doing. But I think my understanding is they were using these sticky resins to print using a matrix printer to print all these large arrays with various agents on it, like albicans. And then you can put on neutrophils from humans and see them swarm to the spots. And so what they could see is when they put neutrophils on, you could cause retarded growth of the hyphae. Okay, so that gives you like a way of saying I have a baseline here with some imaging. And then they were looking at different genes being important and were able to establish that ROS and MPO result are responsible for the early killing. But the nets that we talked about yesterday, those lead to further restriction and growth downstream. And then they're showing that the spleen tyrosine kinase regulates swarming, and they're starting to build a map of various inhibitors. Like, that's a really important one. PI3K gamma is important for early migration, and so then, and then JNK is important for early formation and killing. And so they were doing different inhibitors to show where this was going. But they were trying to, you know, their point was they're developing a model that lets you interrogate swarming, which mm-hmm. is their big thing. And then I'll talk about one more before I hand the torch back over to you, which I went to an early afternoon a seminar on the AAI Steinman Award for Human Immunology Research, which is given to Jane Buckner, the president of the Benaroya Research Institute. This is kind of more of a conceptual talk and looking at some different work over time. I think there are two key things to share from this. One was they're talking about how they're making a biobank early on to study healthy controls in type 1 diabetes. They got a bunch of people in and who were very eager, and they found a subset of these volunteers, their children all had type 1 diabetes. And so they weren't necessarily healthy controls in the normal sense of just people in the wild. And so the point being, when you do biobanking and doing human samples, you really got to understand your human sample. And so parent of someone with type 1 diabetes is different than parent of someone without type 1 diabetes, which is right. still different from type 1 diabetes. So that was one thing that I think is a really important note when it comes to biobanking.
Yeah.
And then the other part was looking across diseases strengthens our understanding. So they use the IL-2 story, with IL-2 being important in lupus and MS, but then bridging understanding across the signaling can provide therapeutic information to both. So this is the conceptual talk, but I thought it was really interesting, and just a couple of points that they made, I think, to pass along. All right, so what did you do?
Well, I started in the morning with a major symposium called Great Expectations, Immunology of Pregnancy. It was fascinating. I mean, when you think about it, right? How do women grow an allograft basically inside them is quite a mystery and quite impressive. And so there were a lot of really good talks. First up was Adrian Erlenbacher from UCSF. And we've actually covered a paper of his from a couple of years ago, looking into, I think it was NK cells in pregnancy. So his lab is, you know, well known, and they've been working on fetal maternal tolerance for a long time. So basically his talk was about glycan regulation of fetal maternal tolerance. He talked about, you know, the fact that basically the placenta is a fetal tissue. And the trophoblasts that make the placenta are kind of invading cells that invade the tissue of the maternal uterus. And of course, and in the case of human placenta, this placenta is in contact with the blood of the mother. And so you're constantly shedding antigen. So how are we not becoming so sensitized and reject this baby? So he had this model in which he had mice that male mice expressed ova. So if you cross with a regular mother, then you're gonna have, the mother will have a baby that is expressing ova, and then you can use that as kind of a model fetal antigen to study. I think it was really good. So he showed a lot about how the model works, and he looked at, well, where is the tolerance coming from, and the main conclusion is that the tolerance in this model is achieved when B cells are presenting class 2 antigen to CD4 T cells. So they are the main mediators of tolerance. And you see that cells are activated by B cells that take up antigen derived from trophoblasts, activate T CD4 T cells that, although they kind of proliferate in response to, in this case, ova, they're not producing effector molecules, and they actually, the proliferation is fairly low and the numbers don't grow much. So they're kind of proliferating and dying at the same time. So basically, I kind of inducing some kind of energy, you know, exhaustion, whatever. So what they see is that antigens that are shedded by trophoblasts are generating tolerogenic responses, in this case, to ova, which is kind of the monopeptide they're looking at, through B cell presentation. And so how does this work? And what they say, what they show is that membrane-bound ova that is on the trophoblast surface is heavily decorated with N-glycans. And N-glycans, particularly those that are cyanylated in the ends, are binding to the Siglec molecules. And they zeroed down on Siglec that bind to CD22, which is expressed on B cells, and basically signaling from the cyanylated antigens that activate CD22 on B cells, generate a more tolerogenic B cell in a way, and then these B cells generate tolerogenic CD4 T cells.
So then why do moms get immunized to the blood type of the babies?
Well, he actually mentioned this. I think it was his talk. So the Rh factor, that one is not glycosylated at all, and it's not presented on trophoblast, is presented on these red blood cells. So they don't get this treatment. And that's probably the reason why that particular antigen is really good at being immunized and actually generates an immune response. He actually did mention that one because, of course, Rh sensitization during, this happens during, not during placental, during the actual birth. Because those normally those antigens actually don't get in contact with mother's blood during pregnancy because the blood streams are separated. Most of the sensitization happens during birth.
The first time.
For the first time for the mother. Basically, you have this coating that induces tolerance in a way. And then the second talk was by Anita Chung from University of Chicago. And again, talking about the conflict, the allogeneic conflict in pregnancy. And I thought it was really cool because she's actually kind of a transplantation person. One of the observations is that pregnancy can generate tolerance towards antigens that are present in the baby. So basically, in humans, there is this paradox, right? So you can tolerate pregnancy, but you reject a transplant. Why is one good and the other one not? It has been shown that pregnant women develop antibodies against the HLA types, for example, of the baby. So the pregnancy is not like these things don't exist. It's not like the mother is not seeing the baby and generating immune response, but this is not mounting a fully rejective immune response, so to say. So what is keeping this immune response, these antibodies, from actually rejecting the baby? So they have these mouse models in which they have BLBC and BLK6 mice. And basically, they show that if the BLK6 mice has a BALB/c baby or is crossed with a BALB/c mouse, and then it has the BALB/c antigens, or the MHC, the main antigens here are the MHC molecule, the polymorphism that comes from the MHC mismatch, that mother will accept a transplant from a BALB/c after this pregnancy. So there's even there's this sudden tolerance that you see because of the pregnancy. So in this case, they do a heart transplant, and the heart transplant is not rejected if the mouse was previously pregnant with a BALB/c baby, a half BALB/c baby. This idea is that, so even if the mouse is previously sensitized, because you can say they also have models in which they do first a skin graft, so you can already generate a ongoing immune response, but then even if you then the baby still not rejected, even if you already generated a memory B cells against these antigens, if it's a baby, then it's protected. So this is very interesting because then that could potentially give you some kind of insight on how you can make a transplant being protected. How can you kind of wipe out those pre-existing memory B cell responses, and that because those are the ones that really generate this hyper, really fast rejection in humans and also mouse models. What they see is that basically, in the case of for example, CD8 T cell response as well, what you see is a hypofunctionality of, for example, CD8 T cells after pregnancy. Even if you started with memory CD8 cells, After the pregnancy, in which their antigen is being part of the fetus, then you see a hypoactivation, which is in many ways very similar to what we understand as traditional exhaustion. So they look into things like tox and epigenetic modification that really resemble like traditional exhaustion. So what he kind of, she kind of end up her talk with is like, is pregnancy the evolutionary reason for exhaustion? Have we developed these exhaustion mechanisms in order to just guarantee a successful pregnancy, and then cancer or viruses, they are just hijacking this actually very evolutionarily important procedure? So I really like that idea that this is where exhaustion comes from in a way. So I thought that was intriguing, right?
Yeah. Do you think it's the only place exhaustion is coming from?
No, but that is an evolutionary driver. You can say, well, it could be to prevent autoimmunity. Okay. But this seems actually more important.
Well, yes. I mean, unless you think, I guess if exhaustion happened in teenagers, which we don't seem to think it happens too much in younger adults.
No.
Right. Then it would matter, right? Because that's before having babies.
Yeah.
But it's usually old people.
No, what it happens in terms of like, right. No, but exhaustion would happen in case of viral infections, chronic viral infections, and it will happen in case of cancer, right? In tumors.
Right, but cancers are... So those are
an undesired situation, which you see exhaustion.
Right, I'm saying, and that comes with time, usually after you've reproduced.
Exactly, so the negative effect is after you already had your babies. But if you don't have your babies, then those genes are not going anywhere. So I don't know. I'm just going to put it out there. I liked it. Think about it. I think it makes sense. Just saying. I really like. So this was from Anita Chung, University of Chicago. Really nice talk. So, and then just another talk that I thought was really good is from Caroline Coyne at Duke University. Basically, they made trophoblast organoids from like every placenta they could get, like literally every animal placenta they could get their hands on. So they really master the art of studying trophoblasts and placental immunity from all types of animals. And I thought it was very nice. Also, she talked a little bit about the differences in different placentas and how the placenta works for different types of animals. For example, our placenta is what they call a hemochorial placenta, in which you have kind of direct contact of fetal cells with the mother's blood. But this is actually only really the case for humans, mice, thankfully for our research, and like primates. But then you have like the placenta of pigs there's no contact between, no direct contact between the cells of the mother and the fetus. And then there's like intermediate options for other types of placenta, like the placenta of bats and cows. And so there's like these four types of placentas across the mammalian females. I never thought about that. It was super interesting. And one of the things that they observe is that human trophoblasts constitutively secrete type 3 interferons. So she went a little bit about what is the meaning of that, are the implications. But there's a lot of other interferons from other animals. And in some cases, interferon is the marker for pregnancy. I think she mentioned pigs, or I don't know if it was goats. I don't know which animal she mentioned, that is the marker that farmers, like if you want to make a molecular marker for pregnancy, is like this obscure type of interferon that this animal produces, that their placenta produces. Like we have this, the hormone, the human...
The one you measure for pregnancy.
Exactly. Right? But then for these farm animals, it's actually a type of interferon that is the best marker, the most marker for pregnancy. So it was a super interesting, very interesting session, I have to say. I'm very glad I went. So, and I think anything else you want to share? Very quickly?
Oh, I have one left here. All right. I went to one was actually sponsored by the corporate immunology section, which was therapeutic intervention for treating immune dysregulation, inflammation, and cancer. Mm-hmm. It's basically research for industry, which is always interesting because they only talk about so much and they go through the really important stuff fast. I'll talk about one here, which is Martin Dahl from Anaptys Bio. They're already in phase 2. They used, they looked at a novel BTLA agonist monoclonal antibody, which in their title is ANB032, a novel BTLA agonist monoclonal antibody, reduced T cell proliferation, inflammation, cytokine secretion, and prevented graft-versus-host disease in a mouse model. So this is what you kind of talked about the other day. Instead of checkpoint antagonism, checkpoint agonism. So BTLA is just a parallel path to PD-1. It binds to HVEM and also recruits SHP-1 and 2, and then turns off signal 1 and signal 2 responses. So interestingly, though, it's also expressed in B cells and DCs, unlike PD-1. So they're using it in dermatitis. One of the nice things about atopic dermatitis involves all the immune compartments. It's not just T cell mediated. And so that's already in phase two. But one of the cool things that they did is they made this antibody that binds to the epitope, and they saw a little bit of agonism there, but then they added an Fc receptor binder onto the end of it, and that's what pulled the cell with the HVEM onto it to make a tight synapse, and then the drug really works. And so that was cool. And they show that in, when doing a human transfer, they take human immune cells and put it in a mouse and watch havoc ensue. If you pump this in, that stops happening. So that was some of their preclinical work that they used to get into the clinic where it now is. So I thought that was really cool. Good drug design. A different pathway showing some of that. Sometimes, you know, dual edge nature, all this PD-1 work and checkpoint inhibition. Sometimes you want to have a checkpoint go on a little bit more for us autoimmune folk.
Indeed. Indeed.
There are some other good talks by AbbVie and Pfizer and some other groups, but I'll leave it there.
All right. I just want to say I also went to a talk from the Careers in Science lecture that this committee. It was really nice talk by the CEO of La Jolla Institute for Immunology, Erica Safir. And I thought it was really nice. So she's also, of course, a researcher. She has her lab, but she talked a lot about her guidance and recommendations on how to make your way in our organization. So she had recently completed an MBA. So I think she wanted to kind of share a little bit of that experience with everyone. And I thought it was really nice, very empowering talk. So I like it that AI is also including this kind of talks. And also what I thought is was funny. Today in the exhibitors hall, there was somebody dressed as a llama for one of the companies. It's nice
I'm
to
happy
walk around.
There was a llama. I didn't get the picture of it. I need to.
Yeah, you should take a picture for your son. It's like a gigantic llama walking around. Very exciting. Looking forward to tomorrow, day four, if we make it. And tonight we're going to the customers appreciation night. Fun.
Today's Sunday, right?
I think so.
Okay.
I don't know. The days blend into each other at some point. All right. So this brings us to the end of our latest Immunology 2024 episode. So don't forget to follow us on X at Immunopodcast to find out what we are up to at the meeting. Also, I may say I have my own Twitter handle and I'm also live tweeting the session. You can visit us at the Immunology Podcast booth on the exhibitor floor where you can win a prize and find out how you can be featured in a future episode of the podcast. Check back here tomorrow for another episode recapping day four of the meeting. See you then.